So we should set the stage here. So John came over to my house for a late Father's Day thing, and he called me out. He said, "You never asked George about crashing my dad's car."
Right back. Keep talking.
I'll just talk to myself. Don't worry. So
No,
anyway,
he can hear you. I can hear you. Keep going.
so John sort of prompted this because John got in pretty serious trouble for crashing your dad's car.
Right.
And you crashed his car well before John ever crashed his car. And according to John, didn't get in nearly as much trouble as John did.
Yeah, I think the difference was when John crashed the car, it had to go to the body shop. When I crashed the car, it just had to get out of the ditch, but I was able to buff it all out the next day, so there was no body shop work.
Oh, okay. Because John was saying that, like, yeah, he got, it wasn't your dad chasing around the house with a belt kind of thing. He was pretty ticked.
Yeah,
Okay.
yeah.
I
Dad
think.
was probably a little more sensitive because the car belonged to him that John was driving. The car that I was driving belonged to Chrysler Corporation.
Yeah, so tell me that story. So he was working for the Chrysler Corporation, so he would get company cars every so often.
Yeah, he'd get 3 a year.
Oh, wow. So he would get a new car every 3 months, every 4 months kind of thing?
Every 4 months, whenever they wanted to give him one, because he was always driving to dealerships to do his job, and they liked to give him the latest, newest, fanciest car to drive to the different dealerships so that they could look at it and then hopefully order them. So
Interesting.
he had, like, Scott, back in, I mean, this is all happening right when I turned 16. So Chrysler is really picking it up and putting out some incredible cars. And I'm 16, 17 years old, and I'm drooling, and I've got a passion for Chrysler products because I'm the kind of person that if your old man works for a company, then God damn it, you work for that company, if you know what I mean. So most of my friends were Chevy and Ford guys, and I was 100% in on Chrysler. So in the early days of my driving, they would beat me.
In racing, you mean?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Because
I thought you meant
Chrysler,
physically.
no, Chrysler engines were not quite up to Chevy and Ford's, but by 1967, the tide changed. And Dad started getting some really nice cars with really big engines.
So I think
So,
you got to set the stage here because I don't think that's a thing. So you're talking about like street racing cars on the street with just random people you would meet.
yeah, you know, Portland, Oregon, right?
Yeah.
Do you know Broadway?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, Broadway back in those days was the drag strip.
Sure.
On the weekend, you would just go down there with your fast Ford, Chevy, or Chrysler product, Mopar product, and you'd go street light to street light.
So did I mean that okay, so all of my experience with street racing, most of what I've experienced has been in the movies, because that's not a thing that happens as much anymore. Did law enforcement tolerate that?
They loved us.
Oh, they did. Okay. So I do remember a story when I was, you know, in my early 20s, my buddy was at a stop, like totally unrelated, like he had a crappy car or whatever, but he was at a stoplight and a guy pulled up next to him and revved his engine and he was a dumb 23-year-old and they raced off this stoplight down to the neck. I mean, it was literally like 100 yards kind of thing. But a cop caught him and I mean, he got like a $450 ticket. I mean, it
Yeah,
was
see that you're younger. So
he was he,
when we were doing it, Scott, we're like the lead of the baby boomers, right? I mean, we're like, our parents would never do this. So because I was born in 1947, I'm one of the first to turn 16 after the Second World War. And so the cops were kind of amused by us. And they would pull, if we were really bad, they'd pull us over and they would read us the riot act. But normally you'd talk to them and you'd go, "Well, could you give me a ticket for excessive noise mufflers? Or could you give me a ticket for excessive noise tires?" Because those were $25 tickets.
Right.
Okay, so that was cool for about 3 years. That's what I got. Lots of those kind of tickets. One time I was doing 125 going up Shoals Ferry Road, that steep upgrade going to Fred Meyer's. And I wanted to see what I could do at the top of the hill. And I went over the crest at 125 when the cop timed me. And he was pretty ticked off, but he was also pretty amused because he couldn't believe I hit 125 because he said, I can't do that. And it was a 35 mile an hour zone. And he said, look, I've got to give you something. But he said, what do you got under the hood? And I popped the hood and we're talking, you know, pretty soon he forgot, you know, that I did a bad thing. And so as I'm getting ready to get back in the car, he said, wait a minute, I got to give you something. I said, well, give me excessive noise mufflers. So he did. So I get home. My dad said, where were you? I said, oh, I was just out cruising around. And I said, but I got a problem, Dad. I got a ticket in your car. So, but I'll take care of it. Don't worry, Dad. I'll take care. He said, let me see that ticket. He looks at the ticket and he goes, excessive noise mufflers. He said, that's a brand new car from the factory. You are not going to pay. You're not paying this ticket. And I said, Dad, it's okay. Just let me hand. No, George, I'm calling him right now. I'm calling the officer because the officer's name was on a ticket. I said, Dad, let me take care of it. Right. I was very firm with him. And he goes, okay, but I just don't think it's fair. I said, I'll take care. Don't worry. I'll take care of it. Because I'm thinking he's going to go, your kid was doing 125 in your car. And I'm thinking that would be it. Well, anyway, I dodged that bullet. That's 1967. The car was a 67 Dodge Coronet RT. Most people did not know what that was. So you would consider it what we used to call a sleeper. So I could pull up next to a GTO or whatever, and the kids in the other car would laugh at me. A Dodge, oh man, we're going to cook you. I said, yeah, okay, let's try it, you know, and then I would whip them, and then they'd go, what is that thing? Anyway, that's that story. So now we got to go, though. That's the background.
Did your dad ever know that you were street racing his cars?
No.
What would he have done if he had found out that you were using his cars to street race?
Well, that's what happened the famous night with the 68 Dodge Super B.
Okay, then that's the next story. All right, go ahead.
So I'm at in 1968 now, I have my own car. I have a 64 Dodge. It's all jazzed up, and it's a stick shift, big engine. And Dad hated it, just hated it, because it had a stick shift and it was rough riding. So that night, I said, Dad, you going anywhere tonight? And he goes, no. I said, can I use that Super B? I'm going to a wedding, and all the guys from the fraternity are going to be there. And it was one of our fraternity brothers that was getting married. I said, that car would be just super cool to pull up. He goes, hey, I take it. Go ahead and take it. Just don't be drinking and driving. Okay, Dad, no problem. So I go to this reception, and I was actually pretty responsible when it came to drinking and driving, because I knew that could put an end to everything quickly. So that night they were passing around. You know how they come around at the weddings with little things of champagne?
Sure.
Well, they kept coming by and I'd grab one, you know, and that stuff's like drinking water. So pretty soon I'm BSing with a bunch of the guys and stuff and drinking this champagne, and I said, oh shit, I gotta stop, man. So I did, but I didn't eat anything. So when I'm driving back home, I'm starving, and I said, oh, I'm gonna stop at the McDonald's, which is at the top of, it's on Bertha Beaverton Highway, whatever the road was that goes down to our old house, but it's about half a mile away. So I pull into McDonald's, go in, get my burger, fries, go back to the car. I'm sitting there, and this guy pulls in next to me in a 396 Chevy Nova. And, oh, I detest those. Just detest them, because the guys that drove those thought that they were, you know, the fastest thing on the street. So he starts bad-mouthing my car, my dad's car. And I said, well, let's see what your car will do against this. We'll go out on Bertha Beaverton. We'll idle along at 10 miles an hour. And then I don't care if you go first or I go first, but one of us will give the signal and off we'll go. And we'll go down to that next light. Ah, that's a good idea. Good idea. So we pull out of McDonald's. We make a right. We're heading towards Beaverton. We line up next to each other. We're just idling along at 10 miles an hour. And then we hit it. And that Super B could spin the tires really easy. So we're putting out copious quantities of blue smoke. Mm-hmm. And back in the smoke, I see the red light going. I went, oh, shit. Right then, the guy that was, and I don't know this guy from Adam, he panics and he starts to pull into me. And I go, oh, crap. So I pulled to the right, kept pulling to the right. He kept pulling to the right. And I let him go ahead of me. He makes a right on 98th and pushes me in the ditch. So now I'm in the ditch at a 45-degree angle. I literally have to put my feet on the passenger door so I don't fall out of the car.
Wait, he pushed you into the ditch? The other car did?
Not pushing like hitting me, but he kept pushing me over, you know?
Oh, you had to get – okay, so he didn't physically push you, but you had to get out of the way, otherwise you would have hit him.
Yeah, it's my dad's car.
Gotcha. Okay, I misunderstood. Okay,
so the last thing you want – well, anyway, I'm in this ditch, Scott, and it's the steepest I've ever been in. I mean, I'm like, I have to swing around. So I'm sitting there with my feet on the passenger door so I don't slide down this thing. The cop comes over. I roll the window down, and he goes, "What in the H are you doing?" And I told him. And he goes, "I never seen one of these before. Who owns this car?" I said, "Oh, it's my dad's company car." He starts to laugh. "Your dad's company car? Yeah, kid. A Super B is your dad." I said, "He works for Chrysler Corporation. It's his car." "Well, let me see the registration." So I open the glove box. There's nothing in there. It's the first night he brought it home. There's no paperwork, no insurance, nothing.
Oh, wow.
He goes, "Give me your phone number." 292-1847. He calls.
Wait a minute. Hang on. Is that really your phone number? You remember it?
Yeah. Back in those days it was. Yep.
I can't believe you remember your phone number. Wow. Okay.
He goes, "Is this Art Christensen?" And I guess my dad said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I've got your son there. He says that this Super B is his."
Well, and actually, hang on a second. So, I mean, this is before the age of cell phones. So how did he call them?
The cop did. He goes through the dispatch.
Oh, through the dispatch. Okay, I was thinking. Okay, right.
But it's all on the radio, so everybody can hear it, right? So dad goes, "Yeah." And the cop says, "Well, you better come down here because the car's in the ditch. And I don't know what you want me to do to your son. Well, the only thing that's at home is my car." So my dad gets my car and comes down, and I see it's not very far, Scott. It only takes like 7 minutes or something. Here he comes.
So are you in the car? There's 7 minutes. Are you just crapping your pants for 7 minutes like your dad's gonna kill you?
No,
you were cool.
Dad wasn't that way. I was always surprised that John said he came at him with a belt. Dad never did that. But anyway, I knew he wasn't gonna be happy. But dad was dad. First of all, he was pretty smooth, you know, and I figured he'd talk to the cop. And so he does. He gets out of the car. He slams the door on my car so hard, I swore it knocked the glass out of the door. And these things don't mean anything to you, but it's an old two-door coupe. And it was something I picked up reasonable, and it wasn't fancy, but it had a big engine and a stick shift. That's all I cared about. So anyway, he hated everything about this car. He gets out. He comes sauntering over, and he never looks at me. He looks straight at the cop. "What are you going to do to him?" And the cop said, "Well, that's why you're here. First of all, is this your car?" "Yes." "Is this your kid?" "Yes." "Okay. What do you want me to do to him?" "He was racing on Bertha Beaverton with your car." Dad spins around. He goes, "That true, son?" "Yep, that's true, Dad." "Okay." So he said, "You write him the ticket that you think is appropriate. He will pay it. He's working." And the cop goes, "Do you want me to call a tow truck to get him out of the ditch?" Dad says, "Nope. He got it in there. He can get it out." And I'm looking going, how in the shit am I going to get this? But anyway, and then he looks at me and he says, "I'll meet you at home." The cop looks over at me and goes, "I think you're going to get your enough punishment. You don't need any more from me." So he never writes me the ticket.
Oh, you did not get a ticket at all?
No, I got a ticket. So
wow,
I'm telling you, things were way different then with the police and with young people.
So was there any damage to the car?
Just scuff marks.
Okay.
On the passenger side, which turned out they rubbed out. I polished them all out the next day. So
there's no body damage.
There's no body damage.
Okay.
So
all right.
I get out, I go home. I know I'm going to face the music. I walk in and my dad, my brothers and sisters will know what I'm talking about. My dad had a robe, one robe that he had for our entire time we were home. It was brown silk. Very exquisite looking robe for those days. Mm-hmm. And dad, wore that all the time. Well, he's standing on the stairs with his robe on. Mom's behind him. I come walking in, and he's got his arms crossed. He's looking down at the front door. I walk in, and he goes, I just want you to know that your mother and I are very disappointed in you. Well, that's the first time I ever heard that, those words. Uh-huh. That hit pretty hard. So then he goes, you will never drive one of my company cars again.
So how long between when he left the scene did you get home?
10 minutes.
Okay. 10, 15. So he had 10 or 15
minutes
to stew.
I was able to keep going back and forth and get out of the ditch. Okay. It wasn't as hard as it looked. So
you didn't even have to call a tow truck or anything.
No. I got it.
Finesse it out. Okay, sure.
Yep. I knew I was going to have to polish it up the next day, but, you know. Anyway.
So he tells you he's disappointed in you, sure.
He disappointed. He said, you're never driving it again. And I never did. So now fast forward about a year and a half later, I'm driving my old beat up Dodge and I trade it in. I get a 1963 MGB that Julie and I used to go back and forth to school in, and it was slow as molasses. And when I got my first job that I've already told you about, I was making good money. So I go to the credit union. They said, can I get a loan? And they said, sure. So I order a brand new Hemi Orange Dodge Challenger, custom made the way I want it, with included a 4-speed stick. And my dad never asked to drive my car. And I never asked to drive his car. So it was a touche from that point on.
Do you think he wanted to drive your car?
I don't know.
Was he just too proud to ask? Not interested in it because it was a stick?
No. I think he didn't want it because it was a stick.
Okay.
But the funny part, not funny, the part that I felt more guilty about years later, I never realized that he took it out on my brothers. I used that for every date I went on in high school. I always had a brand new Chrysler product.
I know. That's amazing. I mean, if you're a 16, 17 year old kid, that's gold, right?
My best friend in high school is Dave Hawk. He a lot of times he has Joy, who's his wife now. And we double date. We'd have these brand new Chrysler products. Sometimes we had a convertible. I mean, it was nice. Well, I blew that for John because John tells me now, I didn't know it, but John told me dad never let him drive his cars.
Well, I'm just thinking, I mean, because Gabe's 16 now, like I've got an old crappy 2001 Honda Civic and I didn't like letting him drive it because, you know, I don't want him to mess up the only car I have to drive to work, let alone a brand new car, a work car, no less. So your dad was very,
adventurous. He was good. He was good. Yeah, I was happy to have him as my dad. That's for sure. For a lot of reasons. But he trusted me, like I said earlier, and I broke his trust. And like I said, everything was cool as long as you didn't lie or break their trust. But when you did, hammer came down.
Okay. And
anyway,
so,
that's the end of that story.
But so John's story was that, just to recap, was that he took your dad's, I forget where it was, to the bowling alley or something, and he hit the bumper of another car and did body damage to your dad's car, which caused him to get very angry because it actually required him to have to get it repaired.
Yeah, it was my mom's. The other part of the story is my mother never had a new car. Dad hated spending his money on cars for good reason. I mean, he was sending people to college and stuff, but John says, and this might be true because I was long gone by now, but he says that Nana bought Mom that car, but she had a brand new 1968 Dodge station wagon, Polaris. It was a huge thing. And so apparently John was out running around. It had a big engine in it too. He was running around and he crashed it. Well, that was Mom's car. So I'm sure Dad was not happy about that.
Interesting. So I guess he did let John drive his car.
But
so it wasn't like he, you know, stopped letting his kids drive his work cars. He didn't.
Oh, it did. No, he did. John drove Mom's car, not the work car.
Oh, it was your mom's car that he. Oh, I misunderstood.
Yeah, it was Mom's car.
Oh,
which he personally owned. See, the company cars, he didn't care too much. They were gone in 3-4 months.
Right.
Anyway, I well, screwed it. I
you
screwed
really
it up.
Did ruin it for your brothers and sisters.
I
huh?
did. I did. I didn't realize it at the time, but I did.
You probably saved their lives.
Yeah, I probably saved John's life, you know.
I'm sure that's a John. Yeah, okay.
We'll just leave it at that, Scott.
All right.
that's a Super B story.
That's a great story, actually. I'm glad you told that story. Do you have any other stories you want to tell?
Well, one thing, I was listening to all the interviews, and two things struck me. And part of it was me, because you did ask me about, you said, did your kids ever get into trouble? But you didn't ask me the cool things my kids did. So I didn't tell you some of those that kind of stick out in my memory a lot.
Yeah. So you, yeah.
Then you asked other people about their jobs in high school and stuff. And I started my own business when I was coming out of high school and getting ready to go to college to make money to go to college. And I never told that story.
Well, now's your chance.
Well, let me tell you about George's Ice Cream.
Okay.
So I had a neighbor, lived right next door. And when he was an entrepreneur. And when he was a young man, he started an ice cream business. Well, he had an Austin Healey parked in his garage that was brand new, 3000, Austin Healey 3000, gorgeous car. Made my heart really patter. And so I was over there talking to him about it. And he goes, George, you want to, I did this ice cream stuff when I was your age. Do you want to get into that business? Here's the deal we'll make. I'll buy the Cushman scooter. You build the container on the back and we'll get it all, the graphic arts done on it, whatever name you want to call your ice cream business. And then we'll split the profits 50-50. So the deal was, you go downtown Portland every day, you pick up your ice cream, the novelties, which came in packs of 12. So you'd get popsicles or ice cream bars or buddy bars or whatever. You pay a nickel for them and sell them for a dime. That was the deal. And that summer, I made $1,050 by making a nickel on each sale. Now, I know you're quick on the math, but that equals selling 20,000 ice cream bars.
So are you just tooling around neighborhoods?
Had a three-wheel Cushman scooter. And for those of us of our age, it was the scooter that the meter maids used in downtown Portland. So they were gas-powered Cushman scooters, sure. Clunky things. And they had a little dump truck bed in the back, a little pickup truck bed in the back. I mean, little. And I built this ice cream container and insulated it out of plywood and then insulated it and put it in the back. And that would keep it cold with dry ice. I pick up the dry ice and I get these boxes, and they were about 12 inches by 12 inches by 3 inches. And I'd pick, I don't know. It seemed like I was carrying thousands of these boxes home every day, putting them in mom's freezer. And then around 11 o'clock in the morning, I'd take off, had a little bell on it, and I'd go down all the streets and I'd ring the bell, and the little kids would come running out, or the moms. And then the best time was after
dinner. Just going through residential neighborhoods?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But I had to be careful because I was not allowed to sell in the Beaverton city limits. I had to be outside the city limits, which put me close to my neighborhood. And sometimes I'd cheat and go into city limits, and then the cops would pull me over and they were not too happy with me. And they said if I did it again, they were going to fine me. Well, the fines were more than I made in a day, so they got my attention. I didn't do that.
What would they have charged you with?
Oh, you were supposed to have a permit every day.
Oh, a permit. Sure. Okay.
And it was like $5. Well, that's a lot of nickels.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, I said, I'm not doing that. So anyway, I got a pretty good route going, and I knew where the dads that had deep pockets and would buy popsicles for the whole neighborhood. And, you know, back then there was thousands of kids running around Mark's age and Ann's age. And so anyway, I just kept doing that. And by the time the summer was over, I had $500. He had $500, which back multiply that by 10. because inflation. I mean, it's so I made like $5,000 selling ice cream, and he made $5,000 in today's money. And I had saved over the years like $500 in the bank. I got another $500 that gave me $1,000. School that year cost me $1,300. And I remember going to my dad in the third quarter and saying, "Dad, I'm run," because the deal was you pay for school, but when you run out of money, let me know. And so remember now, my dad's making $6,000 a year. So, I mean, when we talk hundreds of dollars, it's a big deal.
Right, right.
But I said, "Dad, I need to borrow $200. And he goes, "I don't know." So what happened to your money? I said, "Dad, I spent it. You want to see an accounting of it?" He goes, no, I trust you. But I wasn't expecting to pay that much," which kind of burned my butt, because the girls, he almost paid for them entirely. Now, they'll claim he didn't, but whatever, you know. But I was kind of like, put out a little bit that he was holding back on me, right? And then was kidding me. He was just kidding me and pulling my leg. He goes, "Of course I'll give you the 200. I said, "Well, damn, I was getting mad, Dad." So anyway, he gave me the money, and then I got really lucky. I got like incredibly lucky. I was at the fraternity house one day, and I was talking to my friend Eric Hoffman, and Eric's dad worked for Pacific Power and Light. And Eric was belly aching that he couldn't work up at Merwin Dam, just across the border in Washington on Mount St. Helens, for the power company, because he was the son of an executive, and that made it so he couldn't work. So he's talking, and I said, "Eric, what kind of job is this?" He said, "Oh, George, it's you get $3 an hour." Now, minimum wage was $1. "You got to join the electrical, you know, IBEW. You'll be an electrical worker for the summer, apprentice, and you get $2.94 an hour." Well, $2.94 was like, oh my God, that's what my dad was making, right? Mm-hmm. So I said, "Well, get me that job." He said, "Well, they're hard to get, George, but I'll mention it to my dad." Well, I get a call. I'm at school, and somebody yells, but there's only one phone on each floor. "Hey, George, there's a phone call for you." I go out there, I answer it, and it's the HR guy, ER guy, we call them in those days, mm-hmm. for Pacific Power and Light. And he said, "Can you come down for an interview tomorrow? We have an opening that just happened because the kid that was going to work broke his leg." He asked me a couple more questions because you had to be in school and you had to be studying certain things. But one of the things that would get you qualified is if you were studying engineering. I think they took engineering, business, and pre-law is what they were looking for. So anyway, I get the job, and I am so pumped, so excited, that I get up there and I'm working for a guy named Mr. Kingen. He was the superintendent, and he was one of those old fashioned tough guys that was going to try you out. So the first day I get up there, he goes, "What can you do, kid?" I said, "What do you got?" He says, "This is what I want you to do." I said, "Okay." So he comes back at noon and he sees me kick back having my sandwich. And he goes, "You're going to get that finished today?" I said, "Mr. Kingen, it's done." He goes, "Bullshit." He goes out. Let me look. Come on. We go out. He looks. He goes, "God, man, you did a good job. Good job." He says, "I think I'm going to keep you." Well, from then on, him and I were buds. And it didn't take me too long to weasel into getting to be a mechanics helper and doing other stuff. And I spent the next 3 summers there and paid for my college entirely and bought a car.
You didn't have to sell any more ice cream.
I didn't have to sell any more ice cream. I didn't have to ask my dad for any money, which turned out to be good because by then he had Julianne Marilyn. And in fairness to them, and this is a truism, guys could make more money than gals could make in the summer.
Sure.
And the cost of going to college was no different for you know, if you were a guy or a gal. So, I mean, it was a real blessing to get that job. And I absolutely loved it. It was great. Working up there in the mountains was perfect.
Hmm.
Do you miss? I worked with the electrician. I worked with the machinist. I worked with the welder. I worked with the equipment operator, and by the time 3 years after I got out, there wasn't too much I couldn't do.
So you were entrepreneurial your first year and sold ice cream to get yourself into school, and then after that, it was all just your what's the word? Work ethic. You impressed your.
Well, it was the desire. Part of it was work ethic, but it was more the desire to make money.
That's a good motivator.
I always say my son Aaron's a money man. Well, I guess now that when I look back on myself, I guess I was also kind of a money man.
Yeah. Well, we're back. We took a quick break because Zoom cuts us off at 40 minutes, and George's stomach is now full of steak. But we have another story. George wants. Okay, so to catch people up, Alex and Julia and I were sitting around, and we came up with a list of questions we asked the group of people at the family reunion. And one of the things that a lot of the siblings were talking about was all the mischief that they got into as kids. And, you know, was there any good story? There was a lot of stories going around about the crazy stuff John was doing. So that was one of the questions that made the cut that we asked everybody was, did your kids get into any crazy mischief? And George chose not to answer that. He bunted on that question and countered with, I'm reading George's words. George says, I also want to do a revisit on your question on my kids, but with a new twist. What makes you proud of each of your children? Most parents like to brag about their kids, and I'm no exception. So that said, George, you have four kids. What makes you proud of each one of your respective children?
Well, it's funny because you did ask what kind of mischief did they get in. Mm-hmm. And I was actually being pretty honest. I think they told on themselves. Each of my kids that you interviewed, except for Aaron, told on themselves. But then Karen told on Aaron. So I think you got a pretty good picture of the mischief they got in. But the flip side was they were all early workers. They all... started working when they were 14 or 15, except for Aaron. He started when he was 10. And
what was Aaron doing at 10?
Well, that's one of the stories I want to tell you because it's in today to me, it's funny because I look back and these guys, him and his brother have never changed. I mean, it's the same with those two birds, but when Aaron was 10, James is 6 years older than Aaron. So James is 16. And James had started a lawn cutting business using my equipment. We lived in a neighborhood where everybody had 3/4 acre or more. So we had riding mowers and all that stuff, right? So James sets up, because you know James, he goes out in the neighborhood and he sets up all these lawns, which is great. And he's cutting them. But the flip side is that, you know, this is interfering with James's social life. So he quickly talks to his younger brother and said, hey, Aaron, you want to work for me? And Aaron's like, yeah. Well, Aaron took to doing that kind of work like a duck takes the water. And pretty soon, you know, I noticed that Aaron's the one leading the charge to cut these lawns because they cut them. Each lawn is cut on a certain day. Once a week during the summer. One day I'm sitting out on the back deck and Aaron comes, James is sitting next to me and we're just BSing. And Aaron comes up and goes, James, he's like 11. He goes, James, we got to go cut Mr. Ron's lawn. And James goes, oh, that can wait till tomorrow. We don't need. And Aaron goes, no, we always do his lawn on whatever day it was. And James goes, Aaron, I'm not doing it. I'm going somewhere else. I'm not doing it. And Aaron looked at him and he goes, well, then you're fired. And then I'm thinking, oh, this is going to go over good. But I just keep my mouth shut, watch this dynamic play out. And James spins around and he goes, fine, I'm fired. You got the business.
So did James create this business on his own? Is he entrepreneurial enough at that age just to...
Another money man.
So it was the same scenario as the George and the ice cream. He wanted...
Yeah. And same with Aaron. Now that I look back, I think we have a little streak of that in us, that we do like to go out and hustle. So anyway, the funny part is Aaron then takes us over at 11 years old, which I'm thinking, whoa, that's a little bit young, because the equipment is pretty, you know, pretty sophisticated. And it's breaking down all the time because we're doing my lawn and a bunch of other lawns. And Aaron's asking me, you know, how do I fix this? How do I do that? Well, he just kept taking to this stuff really well. And that's when I picked up on the fact that was really going to be mechanical.
So he's taking your lawn equipment around to these houses to mow lawns?
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Well, anyway, that was it. That's a story on James and Aaron. Even today, when those two guys work together, Aaron is what I call a perfectionist. He is a machinist. There's only one way to repair things, and that's the right way.
Or to do things.
James, for all his work, sizes the situation up, figures out what is needed. Does it have to be perfect? Does it have to be less than perfect? Or does the client just want it going out the door? And that's what he does. So he's very flexible, and he's flexible around his own stuff. Aaron is totally inflexible. Well, when the two of them are working, Scott, you have to get a chair and back up about 20 feet, because it won't be long. The fireworks will start to go off.
Yeah, it seems like a fire and ice scenario, kind of.
And but they love each other. I mean, it's just right. Beautiful to watch, right? And, you know, as far as James is concerned, Aaron is just
anal.
And as far as Aaron's concerned, if James repaired stuff, it would never run. So, I mean, that's just what's going on in their brains. You can see it. So they argue all the time. But then when the job's done, they sit back, have a Miller Lite, and laugh it off. So that's how those two birds get along, even today, when they're doing work.
Do you think Aaron gets his frugalness from you?
I don't know. His mother and I, we don't know.
I don't know Aaron that well. I mean, I've only, you know, met him at the family. I met him 3 or 4 times, and I was talking to Dana, and she was talking about how Aaron just hates spending money. Like, he doesn't spend money on anything. And I was like, oh, okay. I didn't know that about him. She said he only spends money on, like the bills. And then when they go on vacation, that Aaron pays for the, you know, to travel stuff. But she said he never spends money on anything at all. And I was like, oh, I wonder if that comes from George. Cause you've got a reputation for being frugal, right?
Yeah, I can be that way, but Aaron's beyond me. I mean, I enjoyed like ordering a new car when I was young, when I could afford it. Aaron's never had a new car.
Oh, that truck is new.
Aaron's never had really a really nice vehicle. I don't know why.
He has that truck, George.
Yeah, but that's 15 years old.
Yeah, but wasn't it brand new?
No.
Mm-mm. Oh, wasn't?
No. Oh, okay. So anyway, and James has a new car every year. I mean,
it's crazy. Like, I look at James's Facebook and I'm like, oh my gosh, what's he bought this week, right?
Yep.
Okay,
so they're very different. They're very different. But when they're together, it's really fun. It's really something to watch.
Okay, so to circle back to answer the question then, so what should we just go down the list? What makes you proud of James?
James can do more things at once than anybody I've ever seen. He can keep 5 balls in the air no matter what he's doing, not drop the ball, or if he will, he just drops one. And I've actually gone to work because I was trying to figure out how this kid was doing the work of 5 people. And he just has a knack for knowing what needs to be done when, and he steps it and gets it done. He'll be talking, he'll be BSing with you. You'll think he's not paying attention. The next thing, 2 or 3 things get done. It's just the way he's built, and he can do it. So the first time I went to the paint shop, when he was first starting painting, he's working for a little back alley body shop, one-man show, guys from Poland. He barely speaks English. And James went up to him, And I forget how he knew him. He knew him through a friend, and he said, can I paint for you? And the guy let him paint. And I went over to watch him. And James is cleaning equipment, prepping the next car, mixing paint. He's doing all that at the same time. Well, I go talk to Cy, his boss, and I said, how's he doing? Because we got to be on talking terms. And because he really liked James. And he goes, he's unbelievable. He can paint twice as much as I can. And I've been doing this for 20 years. So anyway, then I said, oh, okay, that's his niche. That's his thing.
So this and is not a George thing. Like you don't have that skill? This is
No, learned from you. No, I can't handle that many things. I get nervous if I got that much going.
What about Sherry?
Sherry can handle a lot of things at once, including having four kids. So, you know, she...
I'm just wondering if some of that comes... Yeah, if he emulates some of that, right?
Well, James is Sherry. I think I mentioned before. I mean, it's just the male version of Sherry.
Oh, okay.
I mean, personality-wise and what they like and they do. And, yeah, they're a lot the same. And I would say Aaron's probably more like me. And Karen's more like Sherry. And Amy's more like me. So we got a mix there.
Actually, so I guess that's another thing we can talk about. So I can't remember how it came up at the family reunion. We were talking about relationships with your father, relationship with your parents. And James, we were sitting around the fire pit, and James had like 17 beers. And he said, I have a really good relationship with my dad. And he said, I call him every day. And I was like, wait a minute. You called George every single day? He's like, every single day. And I went, okay. And I wasn't sure if he was being serious because he was a little tipsy. And then I think I asked you about it and you're like, oh yeah, he calls me every day. And I think the day that I asked you, you're like, yeah, he called me three times today. And it took me back. It made me like reevaluate my relationship with my dad. Like I love my dad. He's a great guy, but I don't talk to him every day.
Well, here's what's different though, between probably you and James that's encouraging James to call me every day. He's always got four or five new irons in the fire. And right now we're talking every day because we're going to build him a bathroom in his cabin. And so that takes a lot of effort. We have to talk to each other. We got to send each other lists, who's buying what. And as soon as that cabin's done, Scott, there'll be the next thing.
Okay.
He's going to jack up a Jeep and he's going to get this. And we talk a little. So it's always... Or he's got something going on in the house or with the family or something, but it's always something. And he wants to bounce it off somebody. So he calls me up.
Oh, that's cool. Good for him.
So, I mean, it's not like we just chat, you know.
Sure. I mean, there's nothing wrong even if you did. It made me think, like, is there anyone in my life that I talk to every single day? Like, I talk to my spouse, obviously, because we live together. But, like, even my best friend or my brother, like, I don't think I talk to them every single day. So that's impressive. I'm not gonna lie, I'm a little bit jealous.
Well, he's the only one out of the three that calls me every day.
Yeah,
everybody else has a different pattern, so I feel like the lone ranger.
Well, for what it's worth, I think you sent me an email like every single day for the last 2 weeks, so like I'm almost in there. It's just email instead of calling.
Yeah, whatever, right?
Heck, I got an email. I went downstairs. I was talking to my wife. I'm like, oh, look what George sent me today. Like, so George had sent me photos of his electrical outlets in his kitchen. I'm like, this is what I get from George, just out of nowhere. Makes me laugh.
That's him.
All right, you asked me earlier what I was doing today, so I had to
send you. All right, so we talked about James. So next in line is Amy. What makes you proud of Amy?
Well, Amy's can handle a lot of stuff at once. Obviously, she's got four children. She's working in three different states. She's managing a pretty big group of people that are all males. And, you know, so she also can keep a lot of balls in the air. And she's very thoughtful. She's always been a really thoughtful daughter. Both my daughters are thoughtful, but Amy's always very, very thoughtful. And but I've always been really proud of her at work.
What does, not to cut you off, but when you say Amy is thoughtful, what does that mean to you?
Oh, she just is thoughtful about stuff, you know?
About other people, you mean?
Like her mother, you know? She'll call me and say, you know, Mom, you should do this for me. You know, she just stays on top of that little stuff, the human stuff.
So I see.
She never calls me about, like, you know, her car needs an oil change or something. I never get that from her. So
she doesn't call you to put a bathroom on her cabin?
No. But okay. Anyway, and she's been really, I think you talked to her about going right to work right out of college.
Mm-hmm.
And everything she's done, she's really done well. And I think it's a lot of it is because she's just very sure of herself and very confident and works hard at it. So anyway.
Okay. Amy, I can see that.
Amy is, according to her brothers and sisters, is my favorite child, which is baloney. But Amy loves to tell them that.
Why do you think they say that?
Oh, heck, I don't know. She always did really, really well in school. And frankly, when you do really, really well in school, your parents aren't on your case all the time. And when you don't ever do your homework like James, then, you know, we're on his case all the time. So that makes Amy the favorite child.
I totally get it. Like, we give Gabe a ton of leeway because he does so many things and he's doing so many extracurricular activities and working now and doing, you know, band. And yeah, he, you know, according to Roland, he gets away with a lot, but it's because he's kind of earned it. I mean, he's got his stuff together. Like,
yep.
So I see what you're saying. All right, so, okay, that's James, Amy. Let's talk about Aaron. What makes you proud of Aaron?
Aaron is unbelievable. He's just, that kid can learn to do anything. And he started off out of college really rough. He was going through a job every month. And he would call me up and he'd go, well, I quit another job today, Dad, or I got fired today. And we'd talk about it. And I'd go, what happened? He said, well, the boss wanted me to take some shortcuts. And he was a welder by trade. And he was working on an assembly line. And the boss, two times, he was working on an assembly line building utility trailers. And then he was on an assembly line building mail trucks and for the United States Postal Service. Both times, the boss thought that he was holding the assembly line down because he was putting too much weld on the things he was welding. And Aaron told him, well, you have to do that. If you don't, it's going to break. You know, at some point it's going to rust or whatever. And the boss would go, that's not your worry. Just do what you're supposed to. Skip weld it, get it out of here. We'll sell it. Well, that he told the boss one day on the second job, he handed the boss his helmet, his stinger, the thing that he welded with. He said, well, then you weld it. So I said, Aaron, are you going to get paid for the last week? He says, I don't know. I don't care. So very principled guy when it comes to work. Wow. So fast forward, he has a couple really unfortunate situations. Like he used to work in an asphalt loading plant, and he was the operator, and he overloaded an asphalt truck because he fell asleep when it was being loaded.
Oh, no.
And they fired him on the spot. And
that seems appropriate.
He had a couple rough patches there, and he was going through jobs like crazy. And one day I got a call from my old employment, and a guy I knew was in HR, and he called me and says, is Aaron interested in, because he knew Aaron had gone to tech school and gotten a certificate in welding. And he said, we're looking for welders. So I told Aaron about it, and he was not very excited about doing it. And it was because he didn't feel that the kind of welding he was going to have to do at the plant was not something that he had done a lot of, and he didn't want to take the physical test. And without boring you on the details, it is a very difficult test, and it is different than what he had been doing and he studied in school.
When you say physical test, what do you mean?
Actually do a weld that then gets tested at the test.
Oh, okay. I was thinking like some sort of physical fitness test. You're talking about a proof of work test. Yeah, okay.
So anyway, the process for getting hired was a step process. The first thing you did is take a mechanical aptitude test. Aaron took that test, and Bob Campbell called me up and said, George, Aaron just scored the highest of anybody we've ever given the test to. Well, that made me pretty proud.
Sure.
And so, you know, I called Aaron and I told him, well, he didn't believe it. So he says, I did okay on that test, Dad. I said, well, you can believe me or not, but I got a call from Bob. And he wants you to take the next part of the employment process, which is to take this welding test. I can't do it, Dad. He says, I can't do it. I said, Aaron, what can't you do? And he said, I just don't think I can do the anyway, it's a step process when you weld. And the first pass, we call it, which is the first weld you lay down, is super critical. And you have to go in and grind it back out, a lot of it out, to see if there's any defects in it. Because if there's defects, it won't pass what we call the physical test, which they actually take your weld and bend it to see if it breaks.
Sure.
They bend it backwards. Anyway, so Aaron, I told him, Aaron, how much time are they giving you to do this job? He says, a day, 8 hours. I said, Jesus. Go in there, grind it out until you're satisfied, then go ahead and weld it out, and you will pass, I guarantee. Because now I'd seen Aaron's welds. His welds were some of the, having hung around welders most of my working career, I knew what a good welder looked like. He was definitely a good welder. So anyway, he takes this test. He calls me at noon. I said, how far along are you? He says, I keep grinding the weld. I'm nowhere. I keep grinding it out. I said, well, are you finding bad things in there? No, but I'm not confident just to leave it and keep going. I said, put another one in there, grind it back a little bit, then weld it out. Just do it. He did it. Well, he calls me. I don't know if it was the next day or 2 days later. He tells me, I passed the test. So that was for him. I don't know what it did, but he got that job and he's been there ever since. And after he had been there for.
So he was doing good work the whole time. He just didn't have the self-confidence to actually.
I don't know, Scott. I don't know if it was a self-confidence thing. I guess maybe it was. He doesn't like a lot of change, dealing with a lot of change. And, you know, for him, he had gone to school. He learned how to weld. Flat plate. He learned how to do it with all kinds of materials, but he had never done round pipe. And so I think it intimidated him a little. But anyway, bottom line, passed. He got the job. And about 2 or 3 years later, I was doing a consulting job in the plant. It was the last job I ever did before I really retired. And I went to the weld shop because I was interviewing every single person in the plant. And Aaron had been there for a couple of years. And I bumped into this old crusty welder, and I was talking to him, and he goes, are you Aaron's dad? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I'm just going to tell you, he's a good welder. I said, well, good. Thanks for that input. So then I'm sitting there talking to this guy, and all at once I see Aaron with this other welder head out of the shop. And the guy that's with Aaron goes, where are we going? Why do we have to go? He said, we just got a call. We got to go down to the ABC unit. And we got to do this. The guy goes, we don't have to go right away, do we? Aaron says, get in the truck. And off they go. Well, that's all I had to see, because that told me that he had established himself now in that work group to where he was calling the shots. So anyway.
So if you had to sum up then, what makes you proud of Aaron?
Oh, he's a dedicated guy. I think Dana said he's got a big heart. He helps everybody.
He does, yes.
I mean, if I remember once James was over in Jersey on the weekend and his brakes went out on one of these big motorhomes, and he calls his brother who's over in Pennsylvania, and Aaron said, tell me what's going on, right? And James told me that Aaron threw all his tools in his car. It's like 9 o'clock at night. Aaron shows up. So all the guys that James is camping with, they pull their vehicles so that the lights could shine on this vehicle where they needed to do the work. And then James goes live and calls me, goes, Dad, I'm on Facebook. Watch Aaron fixing this thing, right? So all James and James's buddies have all been drinking Miller Lite for about 4 hours. And here's Aaron, all serious, pulling this gigantic tire off this vehicle and fixing the brakes, right? Or whatever he was fixing in the front of the and you know, you go, how many brothers would do that?
Yeah.
You know, how many brothers would drop what they were doing Friday night and do that? That's the kind of kid he is.
Okay.
For her sister all the time.
So he's Amy's chief mechanic.
Okay.
He keeps her stuff running. And Joe now too. Anyway,
okay, so
you're moving along to Karen.
I was gonna say we're 3 for 4. So what makes you proud of Karen?
So Karen did a pretty good job, I thought, on her interview. Talking
she
about
had a really great interview. I really like interviewing Karen, actually.
Well, when she talked to you about that job she had, and you said, oh my God, 15, and you had a good question there. You said, at 15 years old, did the other kids respect you? And I was even a little bit hesitant when her boss told, because she was an assistant manager, and all at once now she's a manager. And I was concerned. So I decided one day, I asked Karen, is it okay if I come down and visit you when you're having your team meeting? Because without any training, Karen knew it was important to have a team meeting every day before they started. Because once people started buying ice cream, the place went bananas. There was lines out to the street, no chance to talk to her employees. So she would have these team meetings. And I got curious. I go, what is a 15-year-old having at a team meeting? What does this team meeting look like?
Seriously.
So I go down. I asked her, would it be okay? She goes, yeah, sure, Dad. So I sat in the back, and all these kids, 14, 15, 16 years old, are all outside the ice cream store, sitting on the pavement, leaning against the bike racks, whatever. And Karen comes out and goes, okay. She goes, here's what's going down tonight. And she reviews the previous 24 hours. She goes, all right, we did great last night. We beat our target by $300. They used to bring in at each store about $3,000 a night back in those days. And today it would be double that because the price of this stuff was double. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and then she said, anybody got any ideas how we can handle this? Because we're getting backed up, you know. You know, one of the kids raises his hand and Karen goes, that's a great idea. What do you guys think? Should we try that tonight? I'm like, holy mackerel. So when the meeting's over, I pull one of the guys who was a little bit older aside and I said, you like working for her? And he goes, she's the best.
At 15.
At 15.
Wow.
So I always told Karen after that, I said, you've got that ability. Your wife's that way too. She's been leading groups for a long time.
Yeah, that's her superpower is, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I call it wheelhouse. Everybody has a wheelhouse, right? And Karen just has that knack of pulling a group of people together. And it usually comes out good. I mean, remember her wedding? I mean,
yeah.
I couldn't believe she was not even nervous. She like flies in from New Zealand and her mother and sister all nervous. Karen, you don't have a bouquet of flowers. Karen goes, no problem. Let's go out to Al's field and pick some sunflowers. You know, I mean, that's the way she operates. You know, she's quick on her feet. But I was intensely proud of the way she handled that job. And then since then, she's always made me proud with the way she works.
Yeah.
She's a hard worker.
She said something I thought was really interesting. I've actually said it to my kids, specifically to Roland, a couple times. Is she said that how did she phrase it? She said she learned from Sherry to never stand around when other people are working.
Yeah, I remember that.
Which I thought was very on the nose. I was like, you know, that's a really good skill. Because we have a saying in our house. I always tell my kids, like, helping is the most important thing. If somebody needs help, it doesn't matter what it is. You go and you help them, you know, like, yep. So if you got a friend that needs help, if your wrestling team's got a thing going on the weekend and you want to stay at home on the couch and play video games, like, no, it's more important that you help people than you do your own thing. And it really struck me what she said about Sherry, about learning that. So I've told that to Roland a couple times, like after dinner, like I'll be standing around washing dishes and Angie will be wiping the table and my kids will just be farting around doing whatever. And I'm like, look, guys, we're both working here and you guys are standing around. Like, that's a bad look. So I thought that was very appropriate because Sherry was working like crazy at the family reunion. Like, I felt bad. Like, she was bussing tables and I was anyway. So
that's her wheelhouse. That's what makes her happy.
Oh,
place.
Yeah.
Anyway. So that's my kids.
All right. Well, that's perfect.
I wanted to cover really quick is, Al and I have been like brothers since 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a lot of reasons, obviously married my sister. Al and I like to do a lot of the same things, but there's a lot of things that we each do that the other one doesn't like, but we never had, we always worked in our, the areas we really liked. And over the years, and because Al's only a year younger than me, I mean, we're pretty much the same age.
Mm-hmm.
I've always admired his ability to take on a ton of new stuff. He's a little bit the opposite of me. I like to take something I like and then keep getting better at it. Al is never satisfied doing the same thing three times. He's ready for the next adventure. So I think he told you about raising bees.
Right.
Right. And then after that, it was raising chickens and hens for eggs. And of course, if you're going to raise chickens, you got to build a chicken coop. So he finds a bunch of junk around his place and he builds this gigantic chicken coop. He's always doing that. And it made my life way more interesting being around him. And then the flip side is he doesn't like to do the detail work that I like to do. And so we just sit and have a healthy respect for each other and we just work that. And that's just a little side story that I wanted to share because you don't always get lucky like that.
Right, for sure. So what makes you proud of Al, George?
Oh, he's Al's done a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And he dealt with a lot in his life. And he's just a good guy. To me, I don't know if it's a question of proud as much as it is that you can always rely on. If I ever have a problem, especially a personal thing, he'll help you. He's there to help you. And that's nice. And I think again, we kind of grew up during the same period. I mean, we raised our kids during the same period. When they came out to the East Coast, you know, we would sometimes haul our kids down to Virginia and he would haul his kids up to Pennsylvania. So our kids kind of grew up together during those years when they came out to the East Coast. And he always comes by. I mean, he was always we would travel to see them or they would travel to see us. And anyway, it's just something that in a family, it's kind of nice when that happens.
Well, I actually have a scheduled interview with Lizzie and Karen to talk about one of those stories. So,
oh, good.
Because yeah, good. they were telling stories about growing up together. So interesting. Yep. Well, that sounds like a great place to cut it because my wife and I have a hot date with Home Depot to look at some flooring, and
that's exciting. I know. That's actually quite exciting, Scott.
So I appreciate you taking the time, George, as always. I look forward to our next conversation.
Good. I appreciate it. I didn't realize that you were going to try to keep this podcast going, but I think for those that are listening to it every Friday, I think they're really enjoying it and learning.
Yeah. I mean, I'll keep it going as long as we have, you know, stories. I don't know. I think we're closing down on the end because I don't know if people have any more stories they want to tell, but I'll keep going as long as people want to listen. So maybe we'll come up with a new set of questions in a year. I don't know. We'll see.
Whatever, right? Keep it open.
Sounds like a plan, sir.
Well, say hi to Angie and take care of yourself. And thanks again, Scott, for your time.
All right. Thanks for sharing your stories.
Okay. Right. See you.
Bye.
Bye.